Iranian Revolution, the Sandinista movement started in its popular form. The war period in Afghanistan began in 1978 and hasn't stopped since. FIFA scandal. In May 2015, American officials announced a sweeping indictment against 14 soccer officials and marketing executives who they said had corrupted the sport through two decades of shadowy dealing and $150 million in bribes. Authorities described international soccer in terms normally reserved for mafia families or drug cartels, and brought charges under racketeering laws usually applied to such criminal organizations. Whether through convoluted financial deals or old-fashioned briefcases full of cash, people were expected to pay for access to FIFA's river of money and publicity. The federal indictment lists 47 counts, including bribery, fraud, and money laundering. The International Accountability Project releases a report titled Back to Development, A Call for What Development Could Be, which examines forced evictions and other human rights abuses connected with World Bank-funded projects in Cambodia, Egypt, Mongolia, Myanmar, Pakistan, Panama, the Philippines, Zimbabwe, and elsewhere. Among other findings, the report calculates that in four World Bank-funded projects, 71% of those displaced received no compensation for the losses they suffered. ProPublica publishes a scathing investigative report on the Red Cross's development projects in Haiti, or rather, lack thereof, in a piece titled, How the Red Cross Raised $500 million for Haiti and Built 6 Homes. In sum, the group has publicly celebrated its work, but in fact, the Red Cross has repeatedly failed on the ground in Haiti. Confidential memos, emails from worried top officers, and accounts of a dozen frustrated and disappointed insiders show the charity has broken promises, squandered donations, and made dubious claims of success. The Red Cross won't disclose details of how it has spent the hundreds of millions of dollars donated for Haiti. But our reporting shows that less money reached those in need than the Red Cross has said. Profiting from poverty. Again, DFID's support for privatizing education and health, a report released by Global Justice Now, shows how the UK aid budget is being used to increasingly set up private health care and private education across Africa and Asia. As described in the report, some of these private services are being run by UK-based businesses that have an inappropriately close relationship to those making decisions in the Department for International Development, DFID. Others are being run in conjunction with mega multinationals like Coca-Cola, which clearly perceives not only an opportunity to greenwash its brand, but a direct commercial advantage. In sum, aid is being used as a tool to convince, cajole, and compel the majority of the world to undertake policies which help big business, but which undermine public services emerging or thriving. A report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and published in the Huffington Post finds sharp growth in World Bank and International Finance Corporation investments in projects characterized by the bankers as expected to have irreversible or unprecedented social or environmental impacts. From the article, from 2009 to 2013, the two lenders pumped $50 billion in 239 of these high-risk Category A projects, including dams, copper mines, and oil pipelines, more than twice as much as the previous five-year span, records show. Much of the development is in countries like Peru, where federal governments are weak and regulations are lax. Oxfam releases a briefing titled The Suffering of Others, The Human Cost of the International Finance Corporation's Lending Through Financial Intermediaries. The report states that the IFC made $36 billion worth of investments in so-called financial intermediaries, including commercial banks, private equity funds, and hedge funds, between 2009 and 2013, yet does not know where much of its money under this new model is ending up, or even whether it's helping or harming, according to the head of Oxfam International's Washington, D.C. office. The report further reveals that of the 49 investments the IFC made to financial intermediaries since 2012 that it did classify as high risk, it has only publicly disclosed sub-projects in three of these deals. That means there is no public information about where 94% of the IFC's high-risk intermediary investments have actually ended up, said report co-author Natalie Bugalski. As of July 2015, with data current as of November 2014, half of USAID's top 10 vendors are multinational corporations. Chemonix, number 3, John Snow Incorporated, number 7, DAI Washington, number 8, Management Sciences for Health Incorporated, number 9, and Japigo Corporation, number 10. And the number one vendor for USAID, with more than $2 billion in amounts obligated, the World Bank. The New Republic reveals the incentives that financial institutions offer their employees to take influential government positions, and the institution's attempts to hide the exact nature of those incentives in an article titled, Wall Street Pays Bankers to Work in Government, and It Doesn't Want Anyone to Know. According to the article, Citigroup is one of three Wall Street banks attempting to keep hidden their practice of paying executives multi-million dollar awards for entering government service. Critics argue these golden parachutes ensure more financial insiders in policy positions and favorable treatment toward Wall Street. A related report by Bloomberg shows the increase in the percentage of workers who moved from regulatory jobs to banks and vice versa from 1988 to 2013, thus illustrating the so-called revolving door between regulatory bodies and the companies they are charged to oversee. These findings are fortified by evidence revealed in a 2013 investigation by the Project on Government Oversight, which demonstrates how major corporations make it financially advantageous for executives to take government jobs. Through their compensation policies, companies may be fueling the revolving door and making it easier for their alumni to gain influence over public policy. One prime example may be Billy Towson, a former House Republican who helped draft and pass the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, which was favorable to pharmaceutical companies. Later that year, the same month that President Bush signed the bill, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which goes by the nickname PhRMA and represents the largest American drug and biotech companies, was pursuing Towson to be its president. 10 months later, Towson took the job at a reported annual salary of $2 million. An investigation by The Guardian reveals that subsidies totaling $1.62 billion to Shell, ExxonMobil, and Marathon Petroleum were all granted by politicians who received significant campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry. The report also finds that in 2013, the coal, oil, and gas industries benefited from subsidies of $550 billion, four times those given to renewable energy. Reports continue to surface about the expanded role of U.S. government-supported jackals. An investigation by the New York Times reveals the secret history of quiet killings and blurred lines of the Navy's SEAL Team 6, one of the nation's most mythologized, most secretive, and least scrutinized military organizations. In other words, the team operates as modern-day jackals, but do not limit themselves to the assassination of inconvenient foreign leaders, expanding their reach to all suspected militants. In fact, jackals have established their own industry of private security companies. The United States is the world's largest consumer of private military and security services, according to the University of Denver's Si Chao Keng Center's Private Security Monitor Project. Many of these private security companies have become embroiled in allegations of severe misconduct and the killing of civilians. The most well-known scandal, Blackwatergate, involved a massacre of Iraqi civilians in Nisour Square, among other atrocities, allegedly by Blackwater USA, a leading U.S. mercenary company, and the alleged systematic evasion of prosecution by those perpetrating the violence. The New Left Review dissects the spread of EHM attitudes and activities throughout the Eurozone in an article titled, Germany's Faltering Motor. From the article, A small block of northern countries led by Germany enjoys current account surpluses and dictates the terms of economic reorganization to indebted countries of the south under the imprimatur of the Troika. The Troika comprises the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, which collectively monitor countries in severe economic trouble that are receiving financial loans provided for by the EU and the IMF. As Troika Watch explains, essentially, the Troika ensures that the small woman and small man in the street pays for systemic problems in the economy and mistakes made by financial institutions, which are the real causes of the crises. At the same time, in the past few years, European lawmakers have continuously been reducing the rules and controls on those financial institutions and big businesses. The effects of these northern countries as EHMs have been disastrous for other countries in the EU that are subject to dramatic austerity measures. According to the New Left Review, in Greece, the effects of the world economic crisis of 2008 have been compounded by this grinding austerity, resulting in unparalleled destruction of its national economy. The country has now suffered a depression worse than that of the 1930s, with no recovery in sight within the euro framework. Spain, Portugal, and Italy, the latter a founding member of the European integration process, remain trapped in a disastrous downturn. Since 2012, each has experienced an official unemployment rate in double digits, 25% in the case of Spain, with youth unemployment still higher. Jubilee USA describes how Cameroon probably feels hounded by multiple vulture funds, including Grace Church Capital, Cayman Islands, Antwerp, UK Virgin Islands, Sconset Limited, UK Virgin Islands, and Winslow Bank, Bahamas. Grace Church Capital bought Cameroonian debt for $9.5 million and then sued for nearly $40 million, while Sconset bought its share for $15 million and sued for $67 million. Antwerp also bought its debt for about $15 million, but is claiming an astounding $196 million from a country that ranks 150th on the United Nations Human Development Index, HDI, and has a GDP of just $22 billion. Winslow Bank, meanwhile, sued for nearly $50 million for just $9 million worth of debt, and attempted to seize Cameroonian assets abroad as a means of enforcing its victory in court. The Wall Street Journal reports that corporations avoid paying an estimated $200 billion in taxes every year by using offshore banking systems, according to the United States Conference on Trade and Development. Truth Out dissects the World Bank and its connections to the tiny group of elites who control the global economic system in an article titled, "The World Bank, Poverty Creation, and the Banality of Evil." In an article titled, "The Death of International Development," London School of Economics fellow Jason Hickel reminds us of the ever-increasing wealth ratio between the richest and the poorest countries. In 1973, the gap was around 44 to 1. Today, it's nearly 80 to 1. Inequality has reached such extremes that now the richest 67 people in the world, a number of people who could fit comfortably on a London bus, have more wealth than the poorest 3.5 billion. Eric Holder retires from his position as U.S. Attorney General to return to his former law firm, Covington & Burling, whose client list includes many of the big banks Holder failed to criminally prosecute as Attorney General for their role in the financial crisis, including Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup. In an interview with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, Rolling Stone journalist Matt Taibbi says, "I think this is probably the single biggest example of the revolving door that we've ever had." Two major debt crises, in Greece and in Puerto Rico, come to head on the international stage. Because these crises are rapidly evolving as of the completion of this chapter in July 2015, please refer to news outlets for current information. The New York Times also offers a good starting point for understanding the Greek debt crisis. John Perkins' personal history. 1963, graduates prep school, enters Middlebury College. 1964, befriends Farad, son of an Iranian general, drops out of Middlebury. 1965, works for Hearst Newspapers in Boston. 1966, enters Boston University's College of Business Administration. 1967, marries former Middlebury classmate, whose uncle Frank is a top echelon executive at the National Security Agency, NSA. 1968, profiled by the NSA as an ideal economic hitman, EHM. With Uncle Frank's blessing, joins the Peace Corps and is assigned to the Ecuadorian Amazon, where ancient indigenous nations battle U.S. oil companies. 1969, lives in the rainforest and the Andes. Experiences firsthand the deceitful and destructive practices employed by oil companies and government agencies, and their negative impacts on local cultures and environments. 1970, in Ecuador, meets Vice President of international consulting firm Maine, who is also an NSA liaison officer. 1971, joins Maine, undergoes clandestine training in Boston as an economic hitman, and is sent as part of an 11-man team to Java, Indonesia. Struggles with conscience over pressure to falsify economic studies. 1972, due to willingness to cooperate, is promoted to chief economist and is viewed as a whiz kid. Meets important leaders, including World Bank President Robert McNamara. Sent on special assignment to Panama, befriended by Panamanian president and charismatic leader Omar Torrijos. Learns about history of U.S. imperialism and Torrijos' determination to transfer canal ownership from the United States to Panama. 1973. Career skyrockets. Builds empire within Maine. Continues work in Panama. Travels extensively and conducts studies in Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. 1974. Instrumental in initiating a huge EHM success in Saudi Arabia. Royal family agrees to invest billions of dollars in oil income in U.S. securities and to allow the U.S. Department of the Treasury to use the interest from those investments to hire U.S. firms to build power and water systems, highways, ports, and cities in the kingdom. In exchange, the United States guarantees that the royal family will continue to rule. This will serve as a model for future EHM deals, including one that ultimately fails in Iraq. 1975. Promoted again to youngest partner in Maine's 100-year history and named manager of economics and regional planning. Publishes series of influential papers, lectures at Harvard and other institutions. 1976. Heads major projects around the world in Africa, Asia, Latin America, North America, and the Middle East. Learns from the Shah of Iran a revolutionary approach to EHM empire building. 1977. Due to personal relationships in Colombia, becomes exposed to the plight of farmers who are branded as communist terrorists and drug traffickers, but are in fact peasants trying to protect their families and homes. 1978. Rushed out of Iran by Farhad. Together, they fly to the Rome home of Farhad's father, an Iranian general, who predicts the Shah's imminent ouster and blames U.S. policy, corrupt leaders, and despotic governments for the hatred sweeping the Middle East. He warns that if the United States does not become more compassionate, the situation will deteriorate. 1979. Struggles with conscience as the Shah flees his country and Iranians storm the U.S. embassy, taking 52 hostages. Realizes that the United States is a nation laboring to deny the truth about its imperialist role in the world. After years of tension and frequent separations, divorces first wife. 1980. Suffers from deep depression, guilt, and the realization that money and power have trapped him at Maine. Quits. 1981. He's deeply disturbed when Ecuador's president, Jaime Roldós, who has campaigned on an anti-oil platform, and Panama's Omar Torrijos, who has incurred the wrath of powerful Washington interests due to his positions on the Panama Canal and U.S. military bases, die in fiery airplane crashes that have all the markings of CIA assassinations. Marries for the second time to a woman whose father is chief architect at Bechtel and is in charge of designing and building cities in Saudi Arabia, work financed through the 1974 EHM deal. 1982. Creates independent power systems, IPS, a company committed to producing environmentally friendly electricity. He and his wife, Winifred, father Jessica. 1983 to 1989. Succeeds spectacularly as IPS CEO, with much help from coincidences, people in high places, tax breaks, etc. As a father, frets over world crises and former EHM role. Begins writing a tell-all book, but is offered a lucrative consultant's retainer on the condition that he not write the book. 1990 to 1991. Following the U.S. invasion of Panama and the imprisonment of Manuel Noriega, sells IPS and retires at 45. Contemplates book about life as an EHM, but instead is persuaded to direct energies toward creating a non-profit organization, an effort that, he is told, would be negatively affected by such a book. 1992 to 2000. Watches the EHM failures in Iraq that result in the first Gulf War. Three times starts to write the EHM book, but instead gives in to threats and bribes. Tries to assuage conscience by writing books about indigenous peoples, supporting non-profit organizations, teaching at New Age forums, traveling to the Amazon and the Himalayas, meeting with the Dalai Lama, and engaging in other activities. 2001 to 2002. Leads a group of North Americans deep into the Amazon and is there with indigenous people on September 11, 2001. Spends a day at Ground Zero and commits to writing the book that can heal his pain and expose the truth behind economic hitmen. 2003 to 2004. Returns to the Ecuadorian Amazon to meet with the indigenous nations who have threatened war against the oil companies. Writes Confessions of an Economic Hitman. 2005 to 2016. Following publication of the international bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, takes his message of the need to replace the death economy with a life economy on global speaking tours to corporate summits, large groups of CEOs and other business leaders, consumer conferences, music festivals, and more than 50 universities. Writes, The Secret History of the American Empire, Hoodwinked, and The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
This concludes the reading of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. Copyright 2016 by John Perkins. This book was read by Tom Taylorson. This unabridged recording was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.